Hello, listeners. Welcome to episode 11 of the Leaders of Literacy podcast. I'm your host, Becky Lewis, and I'm so happy to be welcoming back my co-host for the month, Brittany Fike. Today, Brittany and I get to sit down with childhood trauma expert Anna Rowe. Anna will be sharing information on childhood trauma and her experience both professionally and personally on this topic. Welcome to the West Virginia Leaders of Literacy podcast, where we engage in educational conversations to strengthen early literacy in West Virginia. Are you ready to become a leader of literacy? Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us again today as Brittany and I continue our conversation on trauma. And today we are joined by Anna Rowe. To Anna, one thing matters most, improving people's lives. For nearly two decades, Anna has dedicated herself professionally to accomplishing that single goal. With passion, tenacity, and compassion, Anna partners with Kristen Sowers and Pete Hall, co-authors of Fostering Resilient Learners, Strategies for Creating a Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, and Relationship, Responsibility, and Regulation, Trauma-Invested Practices for Fostering Resilient Learners, and providing professional development and consultation support to teachers, education staff, counselors, caregiving organizations, and families across the country. As a former teacher, counselor, social worker, and university trainer, Anna has applied her expertise in childhood trauma to all angles. Approachable, kind, and focused, she consistently emphasizes the importance of relationship, understanding its value in the schoolhouse, the home, and the workplace. Early in her teaching career, Anna was committed to letting every student know that he or she mattered and was a learner. She transitioned to the field of mental health with a master's degree in counseling psychology, working with some of the most vulnerable in our society involved with child welfare. Experiences with adoption, caseworking, teaching, and training have all deepened her knowledge base regarding ACEs, complex trauma, attachment, school systems, and trauma-informed care. Thank you so much, Anna, for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
As we begin talking about trauma, I want to refer back to the book Fostering Resilient Learners. And in that book, it defines trauma as an exceptional experience in which powerful and dangerous events overwhelm a person's capacity to cope. So with this definition in mind, what are some of the ways that trauma impacts our students?
I think the important thing here to think about is that kids are coming into our buildings with all sorts of struggles. And it's not just trauma, it's just stress. I like to talk about stress as well, because I think that this idea of how does stress affect us and our capacity and our capability to do our job at school? I think the first thing we have to keep in mind is that it's not about the event, but it's how to interpret the event. So I think a good way to illustrate this is sometimes my siblings and I, we get together and we hang out, and sometimes the conversations drift back into childhood. And I'm always astonished about how I perceived a certain event versus my brothers experiencing that event. And so I think it really comes down to that idea of we can't get caught up in the event, but it's how we've been impacted. And it's that impact that affects our students' capacity to learn. And I really think that the prevalence of trauma is more than what we tend to think about. It's a significant event, whether it's an acute event, like a one-time thing, or maybe it's a chronic trauma or chronic stress that's going on. If we think about the original ACE study, you know, two-thirds of the population in that study had experienced one or more not okay events prior to the age of 18. And depending on where you live and where you grow up, we know that that can be even more. And so we really also have to take into consideration historical trauma, racism, and discrimination as well. But I think it's important that we need to focus on the impact that's occurring, not necessarily the event or get caught up in the details themselves. And while I wish that we could stop trauma from happening, we know that kids are coming into classrooms that have experienced something not okay happening to them. But really, it's about how do we create the right environment for them to feel safe and thrive? And how do we equip ourselves and our teammates with skills to help mitigate those impacts and the intensity that our students feel when they are not okay? And really, that comes down to this idea of attunement. How do we attune to our students and meet them where they're at?
I love your example of what it was like when your brothers and you get together and talk about your childhood experiences, because I know that my sister and I have the same thing sort of happen to us when we're together and we talk about things from our childhood. It is very different how my sister perceives things that happen versus how I perceive things, good or bad, just that we all see things from a different perspective. So I think that is very important to keep in mind.
Yep, that's exactly it.
So you mentioned that we have so many students who are coming into our buildings who have been impacted by trauma. What is the first step in working with our students who have or who are currently experiencing some sort of trauma?
I think the first step is making sure we're creating an optimal environment, a safe space. We want to create that positive learning environment where students know that they are safe. Pete and Kristen talk about it in the book as building the nest. And if you think about that analogy of the mother bird and the father bird making a nice safe space for their eggs to hatch, it's that same concept of we want our students to feel safe. Because safety trumps all. If we don't feel safe, we know that our biological response is that our amygdala is going to be on alert. We're going to be more likely to look for the threat and not be able to be in those healthy parts of our brain, that prefrontal cortex, to access our learning and to learn. And so really it comes down to how do we create a safe space for our students to be regulated and for ourselves to be regulated as well. I love Dan Siegel's hand model of the brain. I've used this model for years with my own parenting. Some of you may not be aware, I was a foster parent for a number of years. Three of my kids are foster adopted, and I have one bio son. And we had about 25 kids come in and out of our home through the 5 years that we were foster licensed. And I taught the hand model to all our kids and really help them understand their own biology of when they're stressing and when they're showing me that they're not okay. How do we help them understand that this is a normal response to something that they are perceiving? And how do we help them regulate and things like that? So I think really coming down to helping students understand their own biology and then creating that safe space for them is the first step in trauma-invested practices.
I think that's a great point, and I also love that hand model, and I love that you mentioned teaching that to children, because I think that is such sort of a simple way that we can get them to understand what their brains are processing.
Yep. I know there's a couple of videos out there on the internet where Dan talks about using this model for kids as young as 5. I mean, I've taught it to kids as young as 3 years old, and while there is a little bit of repetition involved in some of that, this hand model, I mean, Dan Siegel, he's a genius. It's so sticky, and kids just start to internalize it. And I can remember teaching brain lessons in schools to students in preschool or kindergarten, and then I'm walking down the hallway 30 minutes after teaching this brain lesson, and kids are flashing me their upstairs brain on their hand and saying, I'm in my upstairs brain, or some of them are showing me their flipped lid or their downstairs brain. And I'm just thinking to myself, they get it. They internalize it. They get it. It's such a useful tool for students, especially to communicate, or my own kids, to be able to communicate, I need support. I need help right now. And I can't necessarily get the words out of my mouth to communicate that. But kids can quickly show you on their hand when they're not feeling safe or supported.
So part of working with children and our students and giving them the tools and the resources they need in order to communicate how they're feeling and what they're processing is so important. And kind of in that same regard, how essential do you feel it is to build relationships in terms of working with those students?
Building relationships, I can't stress this enough. It is our ultimate tool that we have in our toolbox. And I think sometimes we think oh, yeah, we know building relationships, that's important. We should know our students, blah, blah, blah. I was in a consultation several years back with an elementary school teacher. And she said in this consultation, after I had done some observation in her classroom, she said, you know what? As teachers, we are well-intended. And what she meant by that was many of us who have gone into the teaching field, we get into it because we love kids, we want to see them learn, and we love the idea of teaching. But what she said was, we're not intentional. And I think that's the part where we need to slow down and be intentional with our relationships. Because even though we know it's important, sometimes we get so caught up in other things that are pressing or we feel like need to be the focus of our attention. And really, it's that relationship piece that's key. Harvard actually has done some research around this, that where they looked at high school completion and the importance of having one caring adult. And then what they found was that when students felt like they had one supportive, caring relationship, they were more likely to finish high school. And so if we think about relationship, it really is one of the most important things we have. And it comes back to that basic biological response that we have. It's all about connection. We are biologically wired to be connected to other human beings. And I always joke and say, you know, there's some of you out there that are introverts and you don't really like people or connections, but you still need it. And so you might only have one or two significant connections, but you still need that connection. And I think that's the thing to think about, is that when we have connection to other humans, we're more likely to thrive and be regulated and to do well.
And I think you hit that perfectly when you said that teachers tend to get caught up in other things. As teachers, we're really guilty of letting some of those relationships go by the wayside because of all the other pressures that we have and not invest in those relationships like we should.
Absolutely. And we all have those pressures and things like that. And I think that's where we need to really kind of slow down when we're feeling those things and we are stressing ourselves, being self-aware enough to understand and stop and think, okay, what is going on right now that I'm feeling all of this pressure? Is this good pressure or not good pressure? Is this something that I need to be paying attention to, or is this something that I'm making bigger than it needs to be?
So let's go back to that idea of safety that you were talking about a few minutes ago, in creating environments in which students feel physically and emotionally safe. So what factors play into the role of making sure that you're establishing a safe environment for students?
So I think when we're looking at safety, you hit those two key components of safety. It's both physically safe and emotionally safe. And I really want to look at it the lens of both teachers. And when I say teachers, I mean any adult that's in the building. So any adult that's controlling any sort of learning environment, whether it's the school nurse, the staff that are working to provide healthy meals for kids, to the classroom teacher, to the principal, to the person supervising recess, to the resource officer, to those that are just walking down the hallway to provide other additional supports for students. It's any adult in the building as a teacher. And so when we look at that, thinking about your capacity of what you can control for the physical environment. You know, I've been in so many schools over across the country, and schools are in very different states. There are schools that have been established, you know, in my hometown, for example, for 100 years. We're still in the same building for 100 years, and we've added on, or we've maybe done a little bit of construction to it, or we've got brand new buildings that have been built in the last few years. So we can't always control the physical environment that we're in, but there are things that we can do for that environment. And what I mean by that is looking at things like the lighting, for example. What are some things that you can do for lighting? What are some things that you can do to put positive messaging on the walls? How can you control textiles, colors, things like that in your classroom, or the hallways, or the lunchroom, or the playground? I was working with a team a couple years ago, and they were looking at their recess. This was at elementary school, and just talking about what could you do with the physical environment here? How can you bring in some positive messaging? Maybe bring out some sidewalk chalk and allow kids to write some positive messaging on the boards. I was in a high school not too long ago, about a year ago, and they had this wonderful wall. Actually, there was a couple of walls that were just built out of whiteboard. And I was thinking, why not have some whiteboard markers out there for students to then write or do certain murals or write positive messaging? And of course, you're going to get some of those kiddos that are not going to, you know, write the most positive message, but that can be erased, right? But use the mm-hmm. space as opposed to just leaving it white. Get students involved in this space. I was working with a math teacher not too long ago, and he was a first year teacher, middle school math. And he's like, I don't like my classroom. He's like, and I don't have any money to, you know, make it nice and inviting for students. And then I challenged him to think about things that he maybe had at home or things that he could do or just write on the whiteboard that he had to make it more inviting. So the next month that I had come back for consultation, he'd gone home that night and he was talking with his wife about things that we had talked about. And she's like, well, we've got Christmas lights in the garage that we're not using. So by the time I come back next month, he's got some soft, soothing music playing on his computer through the speakers in the classroom. He's got twinkle lights on. He's got the lights half dimmed. And it just felt like a completely different space. And so I think that sometimes we get caught up in all these things. And really, some of the solutions are just right in front of us. We just have to have some time to think about them and possibly meet with some of our other teammates on things that they're doing. And then the other mm-hmm. side of it is the emotionally safe environment. I've been in some schools where I just walk in and the environment just doesn't feel good. You can just tell that there's this sense of it's not okay. And I think really that starts with the staff. If we don't feel emotionally safe with each other, if we don't feel like we can ask for support or say, you know what, this is not okay, how can we make it better? Students are going to pick up on that. And that also comes back to how do we create those environments for our students to then feel like they can also say, I'm not okay, I need support right now. And some of that comes down to universal language. Some of that comes down to creating those mechanisms where we feel like it's okay for students to say, you're not okay or I'm not okay. You know, going back to Dan Siegel's hand model of the brain and how I've taught that in my own family, my kids feel like they can come to me and say, Mama, and show the downstairs brain or the flipped lid hand model or say, Mama, you're in your downstairs brain. And then for me to then be able to say, you know what, you're right, I'm not. Now, does that happen all the time? No. In fact, I can remember on multiple occasions that my kids have shown me that sign and they'll be like, that's not true, I'm fine, I'm okay. and then of course, then I have to then take another deep breath and be like, okay, my kids are on my team. They're trying to say I'm not okay. And I have to accept that. But when we create these kind of environments where our kids, our students can say, I'm not okay, or you know what, maybe you're not okay, and what can I do to help? It breeds this idea of emotional safety. And really, this comes down to leadership. And I'm going to just talk to leadership for just a minute here. Because as a leader, you have so many pressures on yourself, and I get that. And at the same time, to lead with this idea of showing each other grace and support is your ultimate job, because that will trickle down. And I think that we see this in our buildings. When we don't feel like we're supported by our administration, then as teachers, our sense of stress and our emotional safety is heightened, and we're less likely to act in a way that we would normally act if we did feel supported. And so really, as an administrator, we need to take a moment to reflect on what kind of environment are we creating for our staff.
I really like that you bring up some great points in regards to both physical and emotional safety. I know in my previous experience as a classroom educator, the buildings that I have felt the most comfortable in do have that support from the administrative team. And I think that that trickles down to the students. If the staff is able to model some of that common language and those common behaviors and that feeling of safety with each other, then the students definitely pick up on that and also replicate it.
Absolutely.
I know often when teachers are placed in these negative environments, they begin to see the negatives of students and they look at the challenges and they kind of forget about the strengths. And they may want to change their mindset and become more positive. So what advice do you have for those teachers and educators who cannot do anything about the environment and the administration, but want to change their own thinking and focus on student strengths?
I think first is not taking it personally. We often get caught up in our students saying or showing us that they're not okay to a personal attack. And I think we just need to realize that sometimes our students, they're in their downstairs brain. They are not connected to that prefrontal cortex. They are not connected to the things that they know they should be doing. And they're in survival mode. And so we need to really think about, okay, take a deep breath, take a moment, step back, and really what Kristen and Pete refer to it in their book of purpose, intent to outcome. And this idea of what is it that I am about to do to intervene and help this student? And am I really focused on that final outcome of what I want to see? And sometimes we oftentimes can get caught up in when a student doesn't follow a rule or they disengage in a regular routine that we've been doing since the beginning of the school year and now we're into April, for example, and thinking that of it as something that they're willfully doing. When in reality, they're really just doing something that their brain has been designed to do. And what I mean by that is that that stress response, we flip our lids and we go into survival mode. And so we can't always do what we want to do in those moments. And so when we see a student who's showing us that they're not okay, we need to look at that behavior as a call to action, as a call for them saying, I need support and I need help. And so if we start to shift our thinking of to some of those not okay behaviors in the classroom as saying, I need support or I need help, we would intervene in a very different way. And really, it's some of that comes down to training our brains to be more positive. When we look at brain development and we look at some of the things we've learned over the last 30 to 40 years of how our brains work, our brains are very deficit focused, right? They're designed to keep us alive. Our amygdala, our limbic system, constantly looking for the threat, making sure that we're okay, making sure that we're going to stay alive. And so it's very easy for us to go to that deficit thinking. If we practice regular routines around gratitude, which train our brain to be more positive, and if we look for those positives of our students, we're more likely to find the strengths and find the strength-based solution for any given situation. So one of the things that we do in our family is I have a gratitude journal or a calendar that we use every month. So I just did this simple, like in Excel spreadsheet where I basically do the days of the month, whatever given month it is. And then I have four columns because we only have four of our family members still living at home. Two of my kids are grown out of the home now. So for the four of us living at home, I print this off and then every night, or sometimes we skip a few days and we have to go back and that's okay. We try to say one thing that we were grateful for that day. And so in any given time, I can go back on those calendars and see, cause I usually have them posted on the refrigerator. I can see something that I was thankful for. So especially when I'm struggling, I can see, oh yeah, I was thankful for fresh veggies that day. I was thankful for the fact that my husband took the kids that morning and took them out for donuts so I could sleep in. I was grateful for the fact that the sun came out that day. You know, just these little moments of gratitude help condition my brain to be more positive. And it's the same thing in our classrooms. If we can think about and write down or journal or sticky note or whatever it might be that you use to write strengths of your students. They're going to be primed to be able to be in a better focus to deal with the not okay when your students are struggling, because you're going to see them in a more positive light. And that's also, as Kristen and Pete say in their book, it's going to be a defense against staying out of Oz. Because some of our students, they're going to throw those tornadoes. They're going to throw those moments where they're going to disrupt the lesson, disrupt the classroom, because that feels more comfortable for them, or they feel like they're more powerful because they can control the situation. And it's not about us. And so if we get sucked into those tornadoes, we'll get sucked into those power struggles. And that's not going to be good for anybody. But if we can stay grounded, and Kristen calls these the cement shoes, what is the reason why you got an education, and why do you keep coming back every year? So if we can stay grounded in our cement shoes, we're more likely to stay out of those tornadoes and out of Oz.
I love the idea of documenting student strengths in the classroom to kind of help keep that positive mindset, because as you said, it's so hard to not take things personally when those tornadoes do happen.
Brittany, I agree with you. I think that idea of documenting the student's strengths is so important and eye-opening. And something else that's really important to help changing a negative mindset that's talked about in Pete and Kristen's book is self-care. So Anna, what is one tip or piece of advice that you could give our listeners out there about engaging in self-care?
I can't tell you how many times I have reset. And what I mean by that is reset on my own wellness. And I'm just going to proclaim right now, I suck at self-care. I know cognitively how important self-care is. And sometimes I get so caught up in caring for my family or caring for my students or caring for those that I'm actively engaged with that I forget to do that piece. And so sometimes I have to actively reset my priorities. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, amid some of the things that are going on, I had to do another reset. I had to, again, because things had shifted in our own family and some of my travel and professional life, I had to do another reset. And I think giving myself some self-compassion, self-empathy, and grace to acknowledge that I am human, I make mistakes, and sometimes I can get derailed from the goals that I have for my life, and that is okay. And so really being able to then say, you know what? I am not living up to what I want to live. Why is that? Have some self-reflection. Okay, I can acknowledge that. Name it to tame it, like Dan Siegel says. And then move forward with that and not continue to hold on to that baggage. I think that is one of the things that we need to do. Give ourselves a chance to reset and give ourselves grace and empathy and self-compassion.
For links to all the resources discussed in today's episode and for additional information, please visit our website at wvde.us/leaders of literacy and click on the show notes for this episode. For more information regarding childhood trauma, please visit wvde.us/reclaim WV. Want to learn more about being a leader of literacy? Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single installment. In the next episode, I'm welcoming onto the podcast my co-host for the month, Christy Schwartz. Christy and I will be discussing interactive read alouds and how reading aloud supports children's literacy development. You won't want to miss it. Thanks for listening.